Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and I like to think I choose what I eat. But the University of California says, no way. Habit makes the choice. Now, they put movie popcorn lovers in a theater. Half got bags of fresh popcorn, half got week-old popcorn. And by the end of the film, all the popcorn was gone, stale or not. Next, the same people with the same two types of popcorn went into a conference room. Nowhere near as much of the stale stuff was eaten. It turns out if you put us in a new environment, we notice what we eat. So, I'm eating in my garage. Well, there's more coming up this hour on the Splendid Table. This is the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Told you that you control your food just like an emerald wasp does? Probably not, but if they did, it's quite a compliment. Now, you might not get this if you haven't met Marlene Zook. She's a lifelong lover of insects, which led to her becoming a biology professor at the University of California at Riverside. And now she's written Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Marlene, good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be on the show.
I'd like to begin with a quote that you have near the open of the book. Insects show that it's possible to be unselfish without a moral code, sophisticated without education, and beautiful with a skeleton on the outside. So how do they do these things?
Insects are remarkable in part because there's so many of them that they've been able to demonstrate all the different solutions that evolution's come up with to the same problem. Everything that's alive has, including people, has the same problems. We all need to reproduce and we need to survive long enough to do it. And what that means is that everything all of us do amounts at some point to either food or sex. But they do all of this in vastly different ways than people do because they've got tiny brains, tiny bodies, and they just don't have the kind of sophisticated ability to think that we do. They're operating on the basis of often just a handful of genetic instructions, and yet they're capable of performing incredibly complicated behaviors.
Talk to me about their function in food.
Well, insects are central to food for humans in a lot of ways. Probably the most obvious one that people think about is pollination. Honeybees are the most obvious example, but there's lots of others. We need insects to pollinate crops, to pollinate flowers for fruit and nuts, things like almonds. The almond crop in California is enormously economically important and relies on honeybees. So we need them for things to supply our food. We also need them to actually make food for us, things like honey. But more than that, insects are kind of this unseen master force beneath it all, where they process waste in the environment. They ensure that forest debris gets eaten up so that it doesn't just sit there, so that it becomes part of the mulch. They aerate the soil. They do all these things that enable us to have a world with plants in it, because the plants often rely on insects. And of course, they control some kinds of plants because they eat plants. They also eat other insects that can be more seen as pests and so forth. So they're really central yet unseen to an awful lot of what we eat, even though I know the average gardener just thinks of them as being, you know, stuff that's going to get your tomatoes.
Yeah, insect seems to be a synonym for pest for a lot of people.
And yet most insects, the vast, vast, vast majority of insects are not pests. Even cockroaches, which are so reviled by people, you know, have a plus side. I don't often have success with this, but you know, you really can think of cockroaches as being just regular, lovely, attractive insects, blameless, going off doing their own thing. Only a very small handful of the approximately 8,000 species of cockroaches are actually household pests. The rest of them are, some of them are very beautiful. They have lovely colors. Some of them have really interesting behaviors. There are actually monogamous cockroaches that live in little family groups with the mother cockroach and the father cockroach. Yeah, see, isn't that cute? And the baby cockroaches. you know, I have to confess that even I don't usually have a lot of luck in promoting this to people, but it's true.
You know, another thing that intrigued me in the book was how insects feed themselves. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Insects get their own food in just about every way you can imagine, and in pretty much all the ways that humans do, and then some. Some insects actually are farmers. There are ants that cut off pieces of leaf, use that as a kind of soil, and grow mushrooms on it, which they then eat. There are also insects, of course, that eat plants, insects that eat each other, and insects that eat each other. But they do it in a way that I think most humans would find a little grisly.
For instance?
Well, so going back to the cockroaches, there's a kind of wasp called an emerald jewel wasp that actually paralyzes its prey so that it can carry it to a place where it can be used to feed the offspring. So emerald jewel wasps eat cockroaches, which is probably happy news for a lot of people. But the problem with eating cockroaches is that you can't just pick them up, because they're many times bigger than you are if you're an emerald jewel wasp. What the jewel wasp does instead is sting the cockroach in such a way that the cockroach is kind of paralyzed but zombie-like, still able to move and walk, but unable to control its own body. So what the wasp does is take the antenna of the cockroach and lead it along as though she's walking a dog on a leash, and walk it all the way over to where she's laid her eggs. That way, her offspring have kind of a pre-preserved source of food, but the cockroach can't get away.
That's pretty stunning. You know, there's one vivid image in the book that stayed with me of you standing in Hawaii at night watching silent crickets move across a lawn.
Oh, now that, of course, is my favorite story, because the insects that I work on are crickets, and that's another one of these grisly stories that people seem to like so much. So crickets call, of course, to get mates. That's what males do. But at least in parts of Hawaii, when they do that, they also attract the attention of a parasitic insect, a fly. When the parasite hears the cricket calling, she flies over to the cricket, deposits her larvae on and around it, and then the larvae burrow into the body of the cricket and develop inside the cricket while he's still alive. So again, it's one of these zombie kind of stories where he looks like a cricket from the outside, he walks like a cricket, he, you know, talks like a cricket, or at least sings like a cricket, but inside he's being increasingly taken over by the, you know, munching jaws of this fly maggot. And eventually the fly bursts out and goes into the soil and becomes an adult fly, and the cricket dies. But the fly's been using the cricket for about a week or so as kind of a living food source.
Yes, it is gruesome.
I've always said if these things were the size of fox terriers, you know, no one would ever sleep at night.
That's a very good point. Marlene, thank you for talking with us.
This has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Biology professor Marlene Zook is author of Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Well, Australia has a new cocktail, and it will probably be at a bar near us soon. It's called Absolute Tune, and it's a mix of vodka and Sauvignon Blanc, and it has bubbles. Now, Personally, I do not think this sounds like a winner. Absolute's press release is a gem of doublespeak. This is a quote. "The first taste of Absolute Tune reveals vibrant, fresh tropical fruits with a balanced sweetness through the front and mid palate, which is brought to life through the bubbles, and with a persistent medium-strength Absolute vodka flavor and balanced sweetness leading on to a dry finish." And if you're still awake, yes, that was one sentence. A report on focus groups said that in a month of pouring this in three bars, not one single person would talk to the press. Don't you love it when people blithely say, "Eat more vegetables, cook with the seasons"? Sure, except how will you get the time and who's going to convince your family to eat those vegetables? Well, Melissa Clark is in the same boat, even though she's a food writer. She works full time. She has a family that can be picky. But she has some solutions in her book, Cook This Now, 120 easy and delectable dishes that you can't wait to make. Melissa, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Lynn. Great to be here.
So how do you get your family eating vegetables?
Well, this is the thing that I've really noticed as I've been cooking more seasonally. And, you know, especially in the fall when the harvest comes in and you have all these great vegetables available from the farmer's market, is that it's easier to get people to eat them when they are at their freshest because they taste better. So when I find Brussels sprouts that are just so sweet because you're buying them right after the first frost, and I cook them with, and this is the important thing, a lot of oil, a lot of fat, a lot of butter, a lot of salt, delicious things to make vegetables taste so good.
I think that when people hear a lot of fat, alarms start
You don't have to use a lot. It's about using enough, because what I've found with vegetables is, first of all, if you don't have fat with vegetables, you're not getting as much of the vitamins. You know, you really do need a little bit of fat to be able to fully digest everything. So you can be moderate about it. But we have to use really good, you know, good quality fats. Amazing olive oil, like dark green, fragrant olive oil. When you put that on raw kale, have you ever done a raw kale salad?
No.
It's one of my favorite things in the world to eat. You know, if you get kale that's very fresh and you slice it really thin, it sort of melts in the mouth if you add a lot of olive oil and salt, and it wilts a little bit in the bowl. And then when you serve it, I mean, first of all, any vegetable that you can serve raw, if it tastes delicious, it's amazing for you. But people think, they don't know what it is. You know, they think, oh my goodness, what is this flavor? It just tastes like green. It just tastes like fresh. It just tastes so bright. And, you know, in the winter when you're eating rich, heavy meats, you want something very bright to go along with it. So it's a perfect thing for roast chicken or for a little bit of, for roast beef maybe, or if you have a stew, it works really well. Another one of my favorites is roasted cauliflower and roasted broccoli. I think most people think cauliflower and broccoli, they steam them, or maybe they would saute them with garlic, which is also delicious. But when you roast these vegetables, the edges get caramelized. The interior stays very, very, you know, it gets very soft and very, very almost juicy. And then I like to use spices as well, because spices really help bring out the flavor of when you have sort of a, let's say, an assertive flavored vegetable like a cauliflower or a broccoli, if you add cumin or coriander, it works really well with the strong flavors. It kind of mellows them and everything just gets golden brown and so soft. And again, when you're making something that is so good, it's not a hard sell.
So you find that your daughter likes these?
She will eat it. Well, you know, that's another thing about three-year-olds. They're kind of moody. So I will say 90% of the time, I swear, 90% of the time, she will eat, especially the sweeter things. You know, I mean, yes, she'll eat the broccoli. She'll eat cauliflower when I roast them. The pumpkin and the sweet potatoes, again, you know, fall vegetables, like those you don't even need to sell to your family. Everyone just gobbles those up because they taste so good. And I like to enhance their sweetness. If you accentuate it by using a little bit of brown sugar, maple syrup, a few drops of honey is amazing with these vegetables. And then on the other side of it, if you want to take it into of a more savory direction, lemon zest, orange zest, herb sprigs like thyme sprigs, bay leaves, a little bit of crushed garlic, or one of my favorite things to do is to add chili powder. Just a touch of chili powder with the sweetness of, say, maple syrup or honey, Oh, my God, that is really one of the most delicious combinations. The sweet, the mellow vegetable, and then the spicy chili.
Melissa, I think you've built a new vegetable fan club. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Lynn.
Melissa Clark's book is Cook This Now. Try Melissa's recipe for cinnamon roasted sweet potatoes and garlic. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're on the site, check out our podcasts, recipes, our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and register for our monthly cookbook giveaway. This month, it's my baby, The Splendid Table, now 20 years old, and I have no idea how that happened. It's all there, splendidtable.org. We're going to be back with the latest DIY, homemade mustard, and caffeine addicts in Iowa. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Remember the days of home ec, the aprons, the sewing, the knitting, the cake baking? Well, sophomores may no longer have to fulfill that requirement in high school, but there are plenty of people putting a modern spin on home ec. We're looking at the stuff in our cupboards and our lives and are seriously reconsidering the hows and whys of what's there. Kelly Coyne and her husband Eric Knudsen are at the front of the pack with their new book, Making It: Radical Home Ec for a Post-Consumer World. Kelly, Eric, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So, radical home ec. What is home ec for the two of you, and what's radical about it?
Well, home ec for the two of us is about taking things to their roots, and that's what the word radical actually means. And the broader philosophy that we have is that we're trying to make our home a locus of production rather than consumption.
Did this begin in a particular way for you two, or have you always thought this way?
It started with those tomatoes on the porch, I think, in our apartment.
We always go back to that story, how we wanted a tomato that tasted like something very badly. So even though we lived in an apartment, we started growing them on our back porch. And then once we bought our house and had space, then things started to aggregate like a coral reef, one project after another, one vegetable bed after another. It's just sort of built up and surprised us over time.
And then it kind of got out of control. Then came the chickens. Then came the bees. Then came thinking about
the ferrets and the llamas and the.
Are you serious?
No.
All right. Okay. Just wondering about the llamas. Because you two live in Los Angeles, right, in the city?
Yes, in the center of the city.
And the remarkable thing about Los Angeles is that we actually do have some space here, so you could conceivably keep llamas in Los Angeles. But it is perfectly easy in our backyard to have a few chickens and to have two beehives. That's the wonderful thing about Los Angeles and a climate that you can grow things year-round.
Is there some orneriness behind all of this, some anti-establishment, you know, philosophy at work here?
Well, people always ask us that, and not really. I actually go back to my favorite Stoic philosophers who said there are some things you can control in life and some things you can't. And you worry about the things that you can control. And that's what home economics is. That's the things that are within our household, that are within our power to change. And we make those changes in the household and in our personal lives, and those effects ripple outwards into the neighborhood, into the community. And that's our orneriness. It's not political. It's not left or right. It's something that everyone can get into.
If anything, it makes us less ornery because it gives us something to focus on, something that's positive, and makes us more content and happy.
How do you find the time for this?
Well, we always tell people not to do everything in our book because we're insane. But, you know, it's just one project, one symbolic change is enough. You know, just cooking from scratch one night a week, something like that. I mean, I'm not above heating something up in the microwave when I don't have enough time. But just those simple changes every once in a while can have a profound effect.
And again, we've developed this stuff. Like I said, it's aggregated over 15 years. And so if you come to our house, you say, oh, look at all that stuff. But that was all one project at a time. We always say follow your passion. Choose something that really appeals to you. If you're not into vegetable gardening, there's no need for you to force yourself to do it. Find something that appeals to you on a gut level, like beer. Beer appeals to many people on a gut level. You know, go ahead and learn to make beer. Just do one thing, and you'll find over time that doing one thing engenders more things.
Well, you know, I'm looking. I made a rough list of some of the things I found in the book because your range is pretty stunning. How to make beer, how to make styling gel, how to kill a chicken, one bowl meals, and how to grow your own shampoo. I have to ask you this. How do you grow your own shampoo?
Oh, that's soapwort. There's a wonderful herb called soapwort, which grows wild in many parts of the country, not out here where it's real dry, but I bet maybe you could find it out where you are, Lynn. And it also easily is grown from seed. It would naturalize in your garden and perhaps try to take it over. It's a pretty little low-growing plant with flowers on it. And you just harvest it either fresh or dry and boil it in water, basically. And you make a sort of a thin liquid that is a very gentle cleanser. And actually, it's a historical cleanser. And to this day, museums use it to clean their fine linen collections.
Really?
Their historical ancient linens, because it's that gentle. And it's really a very nice shampoo.
So I could grow it in the summer. It sounds like a weed, right?
It's almost a weed.
But you could dry this and then keep it through the winter and make
exactly.
it and just moisten it and you have a shampoo.
Exactly. You can buy it online dry as well, and they'll mail it to you, and you can experiment with it and see if you want to grow it.
So the basic goal you have here is to what? Be completely independent of commerce, you know, of having to go out and spend money?
No, I kind of like spending money sometimes. Eric hates spending money, but yeah, you know. But no, I don't think we want to be completely independent of commerce. So we live in Los Angeles, and we choose, you know, we could have chosen to move out into the country where we were never tempted, but we like to be, you know, around all this life and temptation of the big city.
I think one of the things is not to shop for the sake of shopping. Certainly, you need to buy things, but recreational shopping isn't such a good thing.
And,
yeah. And we hope that by taking things back to their roots, we can get to the essence of things.
Yeah, we find more contentment in making something than buying it generally. Not just contentment, but pleasure of discovery. We're both people who love to learn and discover, and every time we take on a new project, it involves learning a whole new knowledge set, you know, learning about basic chemistry or the habits of bees or the weeds of Southern California or whatever it is. We just keep learning, and I think we've discovered a way to make our home a university.
Thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you,
Lynn.
Kelly Coyne and Eric Knutson wrote Making It, Radical Home Ec for a Post-Consumer World. Now, I recommend their recipe for homemade mustard. You can customize it with spices or honey. You can find the recipe for mustard on the website, splendidtable.org. That overused expression, good, honest food, well, it does apply to what Jane and Michael Stern post on their website, roadfood.com, and what they talk about here every week. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you guys been up to? What's the latest?
We have been eating and drinking coffee all through Iowa. And when I say drinking coffee, you have to realize that in Iowa and in a lot of the Midwest in particular, coffee isn't just a side dish. It's a real social beverage. You know this when you walk into a town cafe and there's a pegboard. And on that pegboard are maybe several dozen different kinds of coffee cups, each one belonging to a specific patron of the cafe who will walk in and not sit down and wait for a waitress to come. He'll walk in, take his cup off the shelf, go to the coffee maker, pour some coffee for himself, then go sit down with his buddies or perhaps his family and drink not just one or three or five cups of coffee, but maybe even 10, because this is coffee that is made to be drunk.
This is the coffee that they drink in the Midwest, and they drink it all
by
day
the gallon
long. Michael and I, of course, poured our own coffee in somebody else's coffee cup, and it looked like brown water.
If you're expecting espresso, you will be disappointed.
There is a sign that said, "Do not make fun of our coffee. One day you will be old and weak too."
Yeah, it's kind of like a spritzer. You know, you're not going to get a full dose of caffeine by drinking it. It's a social beverage.
So where did you go for this kind of coffee?
The small town of Stanton, Iowa. You'll know you're arriving at Stanton, Iowa, because above the town is a gigantic water tower that is in the shape of a pot of coffee. Somewhere below that water tower is a small cafe called Susie's Kitchen. Now, Susie is best known for her delicious pies, but she also makes a wonderful cup of that really clear, delicious, what's known as Swedish coffee that you can drink by the gallon and keep drinking.
So what makes it Swedish, Michael?
They've got a trick. What they do is they take one whole egg, a raw egg, and break it into a pint of coffee, of ground coffee, mix it up so the ground coffee gets a little moist, and then boil it. And what happens is that egg kind of clarifies the brew. And what you get is something very unlike an inky espresso. It's sort of the opposite. It's very clear and refreshing, the kind of coffee that you can sit down with your friends and drink for hours and keep enjoying it.
And you don't walk out of the place with your eyeballs spinning.
No.
This may be the glue that's held together rural America.
I would put it in the present tense. It's still very much happening.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's website is roadfood.com. So how about a piece of pie to go with that Iowa coffee? You can find Lynn's Pie in the Sky apple pie on the website, splendidtable.org. It's time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. That's what Ben's done. He's in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Ben, hi. Do you have a question, sir?
I do. So I live in it's a nice apartment, but it's got a pretty pathetic little kitchenette
right
area. And I've been trying to figure out different ways to cook lamb. And typically what I do is I grill it, but I don't have a grill available, and my oven is pretty dinky. And I was just wondering if you had any advice on ways to cook lamb.
Okay. Do you usually try to do a leg of lamb, or are you up for any kind of cut?
Up for any kind of cut. Typically if I grill, I'm going to use like a leg or a rack of lamb. But,
right.
I'm pretty much open for anything.
That gets very pricey.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's so good.
I know. It's really dynamite. You know, I'm just trying to think about I'll tell you, there are some economical cuts that are really wonderful, and you can do them on a stovetop.
Mm-hmm.
Really delicious, like shoulder chops or lamb shoulder. You could braise lamb shoulder on the bone or off the bone, and it just is so wonderful. It takes a little fiddling before you get it in the pan. Are you up for that? You know, a little cutting away of fat and that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I'm actually, I'm a butcher at a local QOC, so I'm pretty up for that.
Okay. We've just leapfrogged into another world here. Okay, so we want lamb shoulder. You can bone it or not bone it, all right? And the inspiration, since we have a little option here, quickly tell me, what flavors do you like? Do you want us to go to India? Do we want to go to the Middle East? Do you want to keep it very, very simple?
Typically with lamb, I like to keep it pretty simple. I have had like a curried lamb, which was interesting. I've never had that before.
Right.
I really like that kind of style, but I also like mostly like just simple, almost like salt and pepper.
I understand. Okay, well, this is what we're going to do with your lamb then. I'd say bone out a shoulder. Do you want to make a fairly large quantity that you can heat up or you can share with friends?
Yeah, this is what I was planning on, either sharing it with friends or taking it for lunch for school.
Oh, this would be super. This would be super. Okay. I'd say, you know, get the amount of lamb you want, but you want boned out shoulder with not all, but some of the most of the fat removed, okay? And cut it into 1-inch pieces, even a little larger, because you want it to be able to cook. You want pieces large enough that you can cook it until it's tender. Okay, and not that it's in such little pieces, it's just going to break apart. And then you want some carrots, and you want onion, and you want maybe some potato if you like potatoes. All right?
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to take that meat, you're going to brown it in a big skillet with some olive oil. Don't let the pieces touch because they'll stew. All right?
Yeah.
Brown it over medium heat. Take your time. Let it get really brown on all sides. Take it out of the pan. You may have to do it, you know, in a batch or two. All right? Then wipe out the pan completely. Film it with a little more olive oil. Brown some onions in there and brown some carrots. Salt and pepper them as they brown. Throw in a few herbs. You may want some thyme or some rosemary or some basil. Definitely garlic. Then put the vegetables back in the pan. Put the lamb back in the pan, add some water, add some wine, some cut up potatoes, cover the pan, and just let that lamb cook. Don't let it boil, okay?
Okay.
And just lightly cover it. You can even put loose foil over the pan, okay?
Okay.
And cook it real slow. You don't want it, you want it barely bubbling. And it can take an hour and a half. It could take 2 hours. You want to stick a thermometer in the meat, and you want it to be at about 160 degrees. And you don't want it to be tough. You want it to be tender but not falling apart. And then you don't eat it right away. You put it in the fridge overnight. And then if the juices aren't really rich tasting, you pull the meat out of the juices. You take the fat off, okay?
Yeah.
And then you boil them down until they're really rich tasting, and you'll have the stew to end all stews. And then if you want to, you could do the same recipe, but you could add curry, you could add cinnamon, you could add, you know, a ton of garlic. You can do whatever you want.
Pretty much do anything. That does sound wonderful.
Thank you
very much.
You are off and running.
Thank you.
Good luck with school. Take care.
All right.
Bye, Ben. Okay, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what does the USDA consider a healthy portion of pasta? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what does the USDA consider a healthy portion of pasta? Well, hang on to your fork. It's 1/2 cup. About 1/16 the amount you'll find in the average bowl of pasta in a restaurant. In fact, for most people, 1/2 cup of pasta is not a portion. It's an afterthought. Now, I'd like to think that this is the size of a side of pasta, where a one-dish meal of pasta has some leeway. And Italians have special dispensation. Okay, back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Connect with us on Facebook. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Let's see We have Gary calling from Dubuque. Gary, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, great to talk to you. My wife and I are in the process of buying a half a cow and putting it in the freezer.
Uh-huh.
And it's some great beef, and the people that process it are quite flexible, but I don't know the language to advise them with. And I know I've got a couple of concerns. You know, I've heard that cold aging or dry aging or whatever it's called where it hangs in the meat locker is
right.
really good, but I don't know how long to ask for. And then I don't want to lose anything good to the cutting room floor, you know? I want to be able to experiment with tongue and cheek and things that you've talked about like that in the
right,
show before.
Yeah.
I do a lot of braising, so I want to maximize roasts for braising.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I say?
It's a good question. All right, first of all, you want the meat aged for about 3 weeks. I'm not sure of the temperature and humidity, and those are the two key things, but you don't want it aged in plastic because a lot of times, you know, they'll take the primal cuts, the big cuts of the steer, and they'll just put them in cryovac, and they'll tell you that the meat has been aged. That's sitting in its own juices. What
right.
aging does is it dehydrates the meat, and it also gets enzymes going that really make it taste delicious. So you want it hung, and these people, if they do any kind of aging at all, they're going to know it.
Yeah.
But you want it about 3 weeks. That's where you really get into really, really interesting stuff.
Okay.
Now, you're going to lose some weight with that as well.
Sure.
You know, you're going to pay for weight, and then it's going to be lost. And
right.
they're going to have to trim off some, you know, mold and crustiness develops, and that's not harmful, but they have to trim all that off. So you're
sure.
going to have loss. Now, which half have you got? Is it a long half? You know, are you getting the animal is divided from
yeah.
nose to tail? Okay. You want them to keep for you the hanger steak.
Hanger steak.
You want the skirt steak.
Yes, I love skirt steak.
Yes. You want to have the flank steak.
Mm-hmm.
You want the belly, the short ribs.
Yeah, if you get short ribs, you don't get beef bacon and vice versa, and I'm a short ribs guy.
Yeah, you want the ribs, you want the bones. You also want the shanks. The best stew comes from the leg of the animal, believe
okay.
it or not. Okay, so you don't want them to skip giving you the shanks.
Okay.
And then you want those cheeks, and you want the tongue, and you want the liver. And the other thing is that you want to ask them to take the chuck, which is the shoulder of the animal, okay, and you want them to cut it into a 7-bone pot roast, okay?
Okay.
A chuck arm roast. And these are then things you're going to cut up to make burgers or whatever, or you can just cook them whole.
Yep.
And then what you want them to do is to dress out the entire top loin, because the top loin is where the great steaks come from.
Okay.
Okay?
And when you say dress it out, what does that mean?
That means cut that top loin as a solid piece of meat and with no bone in it, because then you have got the option, okay, of slicing it into steaks or treating it as an entire roast, which could be stunning.
Yeah, although I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to get it frozen after they're
oh,
done.
All right. If they're going to be freezing it, then you want them to cut that in 1.5-inch thick steaks.
Okay.
Nothing thinner than that.
Yep.
Now, the rib area is the other area that's utterly prime.
Right.
Now, you can have part of that cut as a rib roast, rib in roast that could be, you know, a big holiday treat, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And then you could have the rest of it cut into thick steaks. And then you do want the bones,
okay?
And you want the shank, oh, I forgot to tell you, you want the shank cut into 2-inch thick slices across the bone.
2-inch slices.
Yeah, you want that bone, you know, sawed across, 2-inch thick slices across the bone.
Okay.
That is going to give you some of the most phenomenal stew you'll ever eat in your life.
Okay.
With the bone, the marrow, and the meat.
Everything.
And you want the neck, because the neck is going to also give you phenomenal stew meat.
Okay.
So that's the basic idea.
Great.
I think you're going to do well.
Yeah, we're going to have a happy year.
Oh, you're going to have a very good year. Hey, enjoy it.
Yeah, wonderful advice. Thank you.
You are welcome, sir.
Okay.
Take care, Gary.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, Marlene in St. Paul says, tell me about caper berries. I bought what I thought were capers, and they were berries, and I don't know how to deal with them. Okay, caper berries are the buds of the caper bush. And by the way, that's what a caper is, except the caper berry is often on a stem, and it's much bigger. And often it comes salted and in, you know, brine as well. Use them exactly the way you would use capers, except for one thing. They're going to have a lot more flavor, and I think you're going to fall in love with them. You know, crush them, and one of the classics, of course, is capers, garlic, olive oil, and lemon, and you smear that on anything that doesn't move too fast, and you can toss that with vegetables you're going to grill and that kind of thing. So use the berries just the way you would use regular capers. Just remove the stem, and I think you're going to find you're going to like the taste even better. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Sally's on the line from Seattle. Hey, Sally, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Hi. I have a wonderful 70-year-old Gravenstein apple tree. And normally what I do is I take the apples and I put them in a basket out by the side of the street for my neighbors.
That's
well,
generous.
This year I decided to make apple butter, and do you know I've put up 40 pints of apple butter, and I don't know what to do with it all. I've given it away to neighbors, and they love it. But I'm just wondering if you have any more ideas besides spreading it on toast for me.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is just think all your holiday gifts are taken care of. And every time you're invited to someone's house, you know exactly what you're going to bring.
Oh, I know.
You're done for the year, you know. Okay, let's think. How would you use apple butter? Let me think. All right. First of all, so you bake a simple cookie. And it could be something like a ginger snapper. It could be a sugar cookie or whatever. And you bake them small, you know, in rounds, okay?
Yeah.
And then you sandwich them with the apple butter.
That sounds great.
And, you know, I mean, what could be bad, right? And the other thing is that you can make little thin cakes or even make crepes. You can build like a stack cake with the apple butter, you know, where you have thin cakes and you spread apple butter in between each. And wait a minute, how about making homemade really buttery biscuits, big ones, okay? Take the apple butter and spread it on the warm biscuit and then top that with whipped cream, and then put the lid on the biscuit and put more apple butter on and top that with whipped cream.
Oh, my gosh. I'll have to wear my expando pants.
I think it could be fabulous. And you know what? Oh. You could make it. Now, this is just desserts. You could make a tart crust and make like a cream cheese cheesecake filling for it. You know, cream cheese,
right.
Sour cream, sugar, lemon, vanilla, an egg, and pre-bake the crust lightly. And then spread apple butter over the bottom of it. Pour in that sort of cheesecake batter, right?
Mm.
And bake it. And when you cut into it and you get that layer of luscious apple butter.
Oh, that sounds divine.
And then with savory things, you could mix that apple butter with something tart. Okay, vinegar, garlic, right? And
really?
Garlic. Yeah.
Okay.
And now you have a glaze for anything, chicken, pork. You name it.
Oh.
It's sweet, sour, and garlicky, and you could throw hot stuff into that if you wanted to. And you know what else you could do with the apple butter? You could make a chutney. You could take green apples, tart apples,
okay.
And raisins, and onion, and I guess garlic, and whatever seasonings you like, and you could simmer those in with the apple butter and apple cider until you get kind of a chutney. And you, as I said, season it however you want. Fresh ginger, that kind of thing.
Oh, that sounds
and now you've got a condiment for sandwiches and all sorts of things.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Sally. Enjoy it. 40 pints. That's
oh,
dynamite.
Do.
You take
we'll
care.
Do. Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
By the way, this is a woman who has 15 pounds of pears from a neighbor's tree sitting in her kitchen. You know, all these bright ideas. I've got to get home and start peeling. You can reach us. Go online, splendidtable.org, or use the phone, 800-537-5252. I'll bet you remember the Avett brothers burning up the stage at the Grammys and a guy with swinging black hair doing some wild things with a cello. Well, that's Joe Kwan. And although he is known as a cello player, he's also known for his food blog called Taste on Tour. Joe, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
What do you crave when you're on the road?
I would have to say, more than anything, any sort of comfort Asian foods, noodle soups or traditional dishes that my mom made me growing up.
So what's your background?
Korean, born in Korea, raised in High Point, North Carolina.
So, well, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, looking at the way you are with that cello. One of the articles that I read about you, you're referred to as a cello thrasher.
I'm sure my cello teachers of the past would hate to hear that. But.
But there's so much emotion that you throw into your music. Does that carry over to the food?
I would have to say for sure it does. I'm very passionate about eating together and having it be an event. And no matter how big or small the event, it's just as important, you know. Mm-hmm. And if I have friends over, then it's, you know, all around the food, based around the food. So still very passionate about food, and just have to attribute that to my parents, my mom, especially my grandmother, who pretty much raised me growing up and cooking me three meals a day. And still brings back fond memories when I have these traditional dishes.
Did the blog become an extension of that, of sort of reaching out to people?
Yeah, the whole reasoning behind the blog initially was to share my love for food and show people how food really is something that can bring people together. In my family, it brought us together every night for dinner and every weekend with the whole family, extended family included. And then it only made sense that I would try to find pockets of different types of food from all around the country and all around the world at this point.
So what about before a performance? What kinds of foods do you eat before performing? And is there anything you would never eat before a performance?
We have been trained well to never say never. I will say I very rarely will eat anything heavy because it really does affect how light I am on my feet on stage and how I feel. So we generally tend to have salads with some sort of protein, I would say 90% of the time. And then the other 10%, if we have time to eat, we'll eat a sandwich, you know, whatever we can grab, some nuts or something. And all of that usually a couple hours before we actually perform, just so we can settle our stomachs before we hit the stage and jump all over the place like madmen.
So, but now the show is over and you get a chance to go out and really eat whatever you like. What are some of the great finds that you've got?
Oh, man. Some of the interesting dishes that I've come across have been raw lobster tail, which was at this great sushi restaurant in Portland, Maine. There was a place in Columbus, Ohio called North Star Cafe, and I believe there are two locations. And every time we come to Columbus, we always find ourselves ordering the veggie burger from North Star Cafe. We get to Columbus and we're like, all right, who's making the order? You know, how many veggie burgers are we going to have?
So, you know, I understand that performers have special riders on their contracts of the things that they want to have in their dressing rooms or in the green room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually food and drinks.
Oh, you know, we specify only blue M&Ms. And I'm just kidding. We have fresh fruit. Generally, we ask for bananas and apples and orange juice or apple juice, avocados, mixed nuts, about 5 cases of water, I think, and usually some cereal and milk, sandwich meats, and peanut butter jelly and bread.
Joe, where's the decadence here? I mean, I'm expecting Cristal, foie gras, you know, caviar, and you want cereal and you want the milk.
Yeah, we try to be as low impact and as friendly as possible so people will ask us back.
Joe, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Kwan is the cellist with the Avid Brothers. His blog is Taste on Tour, and they've got a new album out, The Carpenter. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Gregory David Roberts, who said, "Food is music to the body. Music is food to the heart." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcasts, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every cook should know. You're going to find it all, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.